All right, so lesson one, page two, the bottom of page two, where it says the expansion of the early church. So we're kind of talking about the context in which Christianity started to spread throughout the world, and especially throughout the Mediterranean world in those first few centuries. And really, what we see happening is exactly what Jesus said would happen in the book of Acts. At the beginning of the book of Acts, just before he ascended back into heaven, Jesus gathered his disciples, and he said this to them. Well, Acts 1, I'm going to start reading in verse 6. So when they had come together, they asked him, this is Jesus' disciples asking him, Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? He said to them, it is not for you to know times or seasons that the Father has fixed by his own authority. But you will receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the end of the earth. And when he had said these things, as they were looking on, he was lifted up, and a cloud took him out of their sight. And while they were gazing into heaven as he went, behold, two men stood by them in white robes and said, Men of Galilee, why do you stand looking into heaven? This Jesus, who was taken up from you into heaven, will come in the same way as you saw him go into heaven. There's a lot that can be said about this passage. It's interesting, you know, the disciples ask Jesus a question, and it seems like he doesn't answer the question, which he often does, right? When are you going to restore the kingdom of Israel at this time? That's the question that's on their minds. Even at this point, you know, 40 days after being with the resurrected Christ for 40 days, they're still thinking in Old Covenant terminology and in those ways. And Jesus does answer their question, actually. What he says, first of all, the first part of the answer is, it's none of your business, as far as the timing is concerned. That's not for you to know, okay? But he doesn't say, I'm not going to restore the kingdom to Israel. He doesn't say that. The way that the kingdom is going to be restored is actually, the gospel is going to go out, and it's going to be preached to the ends of the earth, and that's how all Israel will be saved. So basically, Jesus, by ascending back into heaven, has opened up this gap in history. He's accomplished everything that's necessary for salvation. And so, you know, everything could have ended right then and there after his resurrection. But by ascending back into heaven, he opens up this gap in history so that all of the elect can be gathered in from the four corners of the earth, until that day when he returns, as the angels say here, in glory, and that will commence the final judgment and then the new creation. But really, you know, the first few centuries of church history, you see, and actually even just in the book of Acts, you see Jesus' words in Acts 1:8 being fulfilled. The gospel does go out beyond Jerusalem to Judea to Samaria, to the end of the earth. You know, by the end of the book of Acts, Paul is in Rome. And in the first few centuries of church history, the gospel continues to saturate the Mediterranean world. Comes to this point where it's actually the official religion of the empire by the time of Constantine's conversion. So, and you have that quote from Kenneth Scott Latourette at the very top of this outline that just ponders that and reflects upon the really how amazing that is, that the gospel conquered the Roman world. So today we're talking about, well, how did that happen? What kinds of factors helped to make for a situation that was conducive to the spread of the gospel, and then also what kinds of things were opposed to that, and how did the gospel overcome those barriers. So the first thing I want to talk about is the impact of Roman rule. The impact of Roman rule. And actually, in a lot of ways, Roman rule was beneficial for the expansion of the gospel. And the thing that you should note about that is that that's quite an amazing statement for us to be able to say that. Because Rome was not a good place. I mean, my daughter just read portions of the 12 Caesars by Suetonius. I've never read it myself, but Janelle started reading it and she's like, we actually ripped some pages out of the book and blacked out other portions. It's pretty bad. These were depraved men, some worse than others, but some were very, very, very evil. So it's just amazing that God used this empire and its, you know, its agenda to actually set the stage for his agenda. It's just an amazing thing. And of course we see this in the Old Testament too, you know, God using Babylon, God using Assyria and stuff like that. But it's just, it's a good thing for us to remember as we live in this evil age that, you know, the world thinks, you know, that it's going to be successful in rebelling against God. You know, it's Psalm 2 again and again and again. You know, let's burst their bonds apart, you know. The world says that about God and about Christ again and again and again in various contexts. And it's all futile. The one enthroned in heaven, what does he do according to Psalm 2? He laughs. He laughs. You know, it's just futility. It's an exercise in futility. You know, it's kind of like my dog thinking that he can actually get the best of me when we're out on a walk. And he can do things, you know. You know, nah, I'm sorry, I see all, you know. I saw that wood chip that you just ate, and I'm not going to let you eat it. So, okay, so the impact of Roman rule. A couple things to consider here. Roman exceptionalism. You know, we have, you know, American exceptionalism. Well, Rome had its idea of exceptionalism. It thought that it was special. It thought that it was an enlightened civilization, and it had the obligation to share that with the rest of the world. Sound familiar? I mean, that's kind of, in some ways, that's America, right? And there's good and bad that comes with that, even with America. You know, think about the things we're exporting to the ends of the earth as a nation. Think about the filth that pours out of our nation. You can understand why some people are not happy about that, you know. So there's certainly good things that America has contributed to the world too, so, you know. But the same was true of Rome. There was good and bad. But one thing that was very good was Rome did bring a significant measure of peace and stability to the Mediterranean world by conquering it, by bringing it all under subjection. And really, the genius of Rome was its administrative abilities. You know, Alexander the Great had conquered the Mediterranean world, but really couldn't hold it. And so when he died, it splintered, it fell apart. But by doing that, the Greek language spread throughout the world, and that really set the stage for Rome to step in and take over. And Rome was able to administrate the kingdom, the empire, much better than Alexander had been. So there's the establishment of what's called the Pax Romana, which is just Latin for the Roman peace. And this came after a long period of warfare and fighting in lots of local places throughout the Mediterranean. And in general, there's a significant measure of peace and stability this point. And that's really a wonderful thing, you know, to be able to live in a land that's peaceful. I mean, think about our own nation. I mean, what a blessing it is. We take it for granted, but, you know, when that peace is disturbed, it's shocking to us, you know, like what happened in Baltimore this week. You know, we don't experience that regularly, and it's a wonderful common grace blessing to have peace. But God also used and does use that common grace blessing in order to provide a context where the gospel can go forth. And God did this in the first few centuries. So some things that just practically that made it much more feasible for the gospel to be disseminated throughout the Mediterranean world was you just had peace in general, not as much war. And then there's, you can travel a lot easier. Commerce is made easier. There's the Roman roads were built. Lots of construction, infrastructure was worked on. There was a serious crackdown on piracy. It was a lot safer to travel on the seas. There was societal stability. Theft was responded to. There was justice. Rioting was curtailed. And then there was the widespread use of a common language, two common languages actually, Greek and Latin, were used throughout the empire. Most people would have known one of those languages. So that was one thing that that the Lord certainly used to set the stage for the spread of the gospel. Another was just the attitude of pagan people in that time. There was a receptiveness, that the time was ripe. The fields were really ready for the harvest in a lot of ways. There was the formation of the Roman Empire, as much as it brought stability and peace and opportunities for business ventures and that sort of thing. The downside of that was that because there's this giant empire now, there's a lost sense of identity for people. They used to have a sense of identity in their local community and in their local cult, their local idol-worshipping center, wherever it was that they worshipped. And they still did that, but that was really kind of eroded in a lot of ways. So there's a lost sense of community, there's a lost sense of local identity with this kind of global mindset. Does that sound familiar? It's exactly the world we're living in, isn't it? Think about it. It's very interesting. There's even a movement, the local movement. There's even a restaurant in Laconia called the Local Eatery. People will go to that just because it has the name local in it, because they want to support local businesses and stuff like that. So there was that sort of a mindset. There's this lost sense of identity. Who are we anymore? We used to be Yankees. We used to be New Englanders, but now we're just kind of part of the soup in America. Also there is a sense of disillusionment among people that resulted from the transition from a republican form of government to an imperial form of government. And this was what was happening with the Roman Empire. It started out as more republican in terms of its way of organization, and it transitioned to being an empire. With the republicanism, there was a sense of sharing in the government and participating in it. But when you transition to imperial rule, it becomes much more like a dictatorship. They didn't call Caesar a king, but that's basically what he was. Then there was a state religion. There was the imperial cult, the worship of the emperor. And really, that was just a matter of political expediency. It was beneficial for the empire. It was, civil religion is what it was. Religion in the service of the state. Again, something that we should be familiar with. That idea is a part of our country, too. And people got cynical about that. If religion is just being used to bolster somebody's political agenda, what use is it? It's not real. It's just a means to an end. So that led to a sense of cynicism and a longing. It left an opening there for some a quest for spiritual meaning and significance. Also, a lot of these things are similar to our context, but this next point is really very different. In the first century and the second century, the thing that people were really impressed by was antiquity. If something was old, it was much, much more, it was viewed with much more credibility. If you had an ancient, you know, if you had a religion that had an ancient history, it was viewed as being more credible. And of course, that's what I mean. That's totally the opposite of the way things are today. We exalt what is new, what is novel. We're not interested in what's popular today. We're interested in what's popular tomorrow. You know, I mean, we're so addicted to novelty. So it was really the opposite mindset back in the first few centuries. And Judaism had gained attention precisely for that reason. It was an old religion, and its scriptures went back all the way to the beginning of the world with creation, a creation account. So Judaism was attractive and had been gaining ground throughout the Mediterranean world. There were a lot of converts to Judaism throughout the Mediterranean world. Also, the influence of Greek philosophy, people like Plato, that got people thinking a little more rationally, and as they evaluated the ancient religions of the Roman world and of the Greek world, they realized that really this just didn't seem very plausible. It just didn't seem very rational. And so they began to be kind of cynical about the ancient myths and mythology. And then also, the other downside of those myths were the gods are just not very interesting in those stories. They're really pretty immoral. It's the human beings that are much more interesting characters, you know, when you read ancient mythology. The gods are kind of, you know, they're impatient, they're volatile, you know, they swing, their mood swings, you know, back and forth. And really, there was a sense of immorality there with the pagan gods, and that was unattractive. So all those factors contributed to kind of creating an opening for the gospel. Now, Christianity certainly had rivals in those first few centuries. There were other religions and philosophies that tried to step in and fill the void. One was mystery religions, different kinds of local cults that engaged in secret ceremonies, and they gave people that sense of belonging that they had been looking for. You know, you can be a part of something now. And also gave people a hope of immortality. Do we have any mystery religions today? Yeah, I was just thinking of the Masons. Yeah, it's kind of like that. Yeah, the secret society. Yeah, you know, and they're guarding the national treasure. You ever see that movie? You know? It's a good movie. But. So there's that. There was the mystery religions. Then there's Gnosticism, which we'll be talking more about next week. But Gnosticism was really a Christian heresy. At least that's primarily how we're going to be focusing upon it. But in Gnosticism, the word Gnostic just comes from the Greek word that means knowledge. Gnosis means knowledge. And in Gnosticism, there's this idea that there's a sharp distinction between the spiritual world and the material world. And the material world is not good. And really, the salvation for a Gnostic is escape from the material and the physical. And this has a lot of similarity with Plato's philosophy. But so Gnosticism promised that you could attain to some secret knowledge that was for the privileged few, very similar to mystery religions. There's overlap there. The goal, again, is escape from the physical realm. And then a couple schools of philosophy. There were others, Stoicism and Epicureanism. And in Stoicism, it's a pantheistic mindset, which means that they view everything as God. God is the world. Pan just means everything. So the world is divine. Buddhism, for example, is pantheistic. And so for the Stoic, there's an emphasis upon self-control and personal morality, and trying to understand the nature of the world and to just fit in and blend in with it. And then with Epicureanism, you know, we use that word today in a little bit of a different sense. We tend to think of it as someone who has a real cultivated palate and is really devoted to the pursuit of pleasure, kind of hedonistic. And that's not quite the way Epicurean philosophy was. It was focused on seeking pleasure, but not actually in a hedonistic way. It actually had a higher, it took a higher road. It sought to seek pleasure in the mind, in friendship, in contentment. And so you did need to suppress your desires, actually, in order to attain to true happiness, according to the Epicurean. And they also taught that you should not fear death. So just some other challenges that Christianity faced, and then we'll take time for any questions or comments before we move on. One challenge is that because there was an attraction to old things, ancient things, things that were new were not so attractive. And Christianity, you know, it was kind of both. You know, it was claiming that it was actually the fulfillment of Judaism, which is what we believe. But really, you know, its founder, Jesus, at least from a human point of view, you know, he comes on the scene in the year 4 BC. And, you know, do you ever wonder about that? You know, why? How did that happen? Well, the calendar wasn't invented, the one we use, until like the 6th century A.D., and the guy who came up with it made a mistake, basically. So the reason why we say 4, or maybe even as early as 6 BC, is because Herod the Great died in 4 BC. And we know that Jesus was, you know, there was an overlap between their lifetime. So we know from other documents that Herod died in 4 BC. So Jesus couldn't have been born after that, really. What's that? Is that what you would you add the 4 years? Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, it's 2019. So yeah, we're actually in the future. Yeah. So you can see how that would work, you know, especially for someone who's hearing this for the first time, they would think, oh, this is some new religion, you know? And well, we're not interested in that. But again, you see God's wisdom in, you know, he established synagogues all throughout the Mediterranean world so that Paul could go to those and use those as the places where he was presenting the gospel. And so there's this connection with that which is very old, with Judaism. And so even though there was this sense of newness, there's also a way to present it that showed that, no, actually it's not new. Christians also were a very small minority in a very sophisticated society. You know, if you're small, you know, you're kind of just, you're not important, you're not significant. And we know what that's like, you know, that, you know, small groups are just kind of brushed aside. You know, we want to be influential in our society, you know. And well, again, God worked by his power, you know, not through the influence that the church gained in the world. And as we're going to see, when the church finally did gain influence in the world, things started to go downhill in a lot of ways. You know, when Constantine converted, there were a lot of benefits, but there was a downside to that too. Then there was also confusion among outsiders over the exact nature of a lot of Christian teachings. And so you would have charges being made that Christians are cannibals. Why do you think people would say that? Because of the Lord's Supper, right? They'd hear about this and be like, "You eat the body and blood of this guy? What are you?" And then atheism. There's the charge of atheism. Where would that come from?
What the bishop was that?
There's no physical God, right? Yeah, there's no representation. And this was something that was mind-blowing for ancient people, both about Judaism and Christianity. So you don't actually have anything in your temple? What? So you don't have a God? You know, that's the way they thought. So it was foolishness in the eyes of the world. And again, that's something that's hard for us to wrap our mind around because that's just not the world we live in, you know. So there was another challenge, as there was a significant degree of instability in the church itself because of immorality and because of a false doctrine within the church already. We see it as early as the New Testament, don't we? You read 1 Corinthians. There are some serious moral issues in the church in Corinth. You know, there's some serious sexual immorality going on, and Paul has to address that. There's already an excommunication in that church, you know. So, and then false teaching. You know, there's the book of Galatians, for example. Paul is addressing the whole Judaizing issue. You know, the group of people that said that if you convert to Christianity as a Gentile, you need to become a Jew. You need to be circumcised. You need to follow the food laws and everything. And Paul confronts that in Galatians especially and says, no, you don't. And actually you have it confronted in Acts 15 too at the Jerusalem Council. And then there was also persecution from the outside. And this came in waves. At first it was kind of more localized, and eventually it became empire-wide, as we'll see in just a few moments. But the persecution was largely due to a refusal to compromise with paganism. Because, you know, paganism was very flexible, you know, very willing to incorporate other gods, but Christianity and Judaism were not. And so there's a refusal to participate in customs that united society, especially the imperial cult. You know, if you're not going to participate in those things, then there's going to be serious consequences for you. And also, Christianity was opposed because it was attracting new converts. It was gaining steam. And people were beginning to say, we're going to have to pay attention to this. This could get out of hand. So here's a quote from Kenneth Scott Lauderette. As far as why the persecution happened, this is really getting at more the spiritual reason. It says, in a broader and deeper sense, the dislike and the persecution which grew out of it and accompanied it were evidence that, as Jesus had said in the gospel, something had entered the world with which the world was at enmity. So, I mean, really, that is the spiritual reason why the church was persecuted. The gospel, the church is, or the world is opposed to the gospel. Okay, so let me pause and see if there are any questions or comments at this point before we move on. Anything you'd like clarification on or a comment? Mm-hmm. Mike? Yeah, well, there were privileges, you know, that came with being a Roman citizen, yeah. But yeah, not everyone within the empire was technically a citizen. They were a subject, you know. But there was an upside to, you know, being a Roman citizen. I don't know all the upside. One I know was you couldn't be crucified, you know. Instead of being crucified, you'd have your head cut off, you know, or something like that, which is what happened to Paul. So, and that was a benefit. You know, I mean, we might not think of it, but it'd be a lot faster, you know. So.
And the other thing is just going on persecution from outside. Most, like, guilds and stuff have their own pagan gods.
Yeah.
And so if you were a silversmith, you would be from the church, and you wouldn't want to participate in that.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that's possible, but there's friction.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so Yeah, there were trade guilds in cities, and they would have a patron deity for, you know, the silversmiths in town, and they would have a, you know, a little cult surrounding that deity. And if you didn't participate in that, then you might not be able to ply your trade in town. And actually, I think Revelation in the seven letters to the churches, I think that's what Jesus is getting at in a couple of those instances there, that some within the church were compromising and were participating, and Jesus saying you can't do that, even though it may mean your livelihood. That this is more important than your life, than your physical livelihood. So. I think as we think about these things too, we begin to see there's a lot in common with our culture. You know, I mean, there's some parallels here.
Society hasn't evolved.
Yeah, there's nothing new under the sun. Yeah. Right. Other comments or questions? Yes, John. Have control over him in some ways. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, it's... Yeah, there is an attraction to that. You know, I mean, there's an attraction in that. You know, we kind of have a sense of power. It's magical. It feels like it's more guaranteed, maybe. If you just do these things, then you're going to... You know. Sure, yeah, in a different sense. Yeah, they're in a different sense, yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And you know, the New Testament talks about idolatry in those kinds of ways too. Yeah. All right. Well, let me move on. So now we want to talk about some of the early church leaders, and then we'll talk about persecution in the early church. But the first group of leaders, major leaders in the early church, after the deaths of the apostles, are identified as the apostolic fathers. The apostolic fathers. So sometimes you hear the word fathers and it's capitalized, and sometimes they're called the church fathers, and that would both be capitalized. And that's just referring to early teachers in the first few centuries of church history that wrote significantly and were influential and helpful in formulating different doctrines, and sometimes were not so helpful. So the church fathers is the designation that's given to that group of people. A subcategory of the church fathers is the apostolic fathers. So the apostolic fathers are church fathers, but they're a little more specific. They're called the apostolic fathers because the claim is made that they had an actual connection to the apostles, that they were actually personally taught by the apostles. And we don't know, you know, all the, you know, ins and outs of that, whether or not that's actually accurate or not. But it does seem that, at least for a number of them, that there is, that is viable. But they lived in the first half of the second century AD. And there's five of them. Clement of Rome and Hermas of Rome, Ignatius of Antioch, Polycarp of Smyrna, which is in Asia Minor, and Barnabas of Alexandria, which is in Egypt. And this is probably not the Barnabas who was Paul's companion. There's been debate about that over the years, but probably a different Barnabas. And one of the things, if you read the apostolic fathers, I was reading them a few years ago, and one of the things that really came through is it's not that impressive. Like, it's just, you know, it's kind of simplistic, and it tends to be moralistic. They really focus on ethics and how to live, and in some ways, in a way that's disconnected with the gospel. And you don't see that in the New Testament. The New Testament talks about ethics. It talks about morality. But it's always connected to the gospel. Paul is always using the therefore, right? You know, this is what you are, therefore, live this way. You know, be what you are. You know, there's that close connection. It's just so amazing throughout the New Testament. But that's not so evident with the apostolic father. So already, you know, the first generation after the apostles, you kind of have a decline in doctrinal understanding. And really, that shouldn't surprise us, because the apostles were inspired by the Spirit, right? The apostolic fathers weren't. It shouldn't be surprising. It's not that there's not anything good in the apostolic fathers. It's just, it's not the best, even among human writings. Some of the ones that came after them were much, much more helpful. Then there were the apologists also, and these were men who arose in the first century to defend the faith against heretics within and critics without. And the apologists were not systematic theologians, so they weren't, you know, writing the Westminster Confession of Faith or, you know, those kinds of things. They were dealing with specific issues. So sometimes you refer to that as an occasional theologian. You're addressing certain issues on specific occasions, or polemical theologians. They're engaging in polemics, debates. So the apologists, the most famous would be Justin Martyr, by the way. Origen would be another one. We'll talk about Origen next week. But the apologists pointed out the immorality of the pagan gods, the corrupt lives of pagan people. They emphasized Christianity's monotheism and showed how that's a good thing. The doctrinal consistency of Christianity, its morality, and its spiritual worship. They actually said that that's a good thing, that we don't have idols and stuff like that. And they tried to explain why. So, I'm just going to try and get through the outline. I want to talk about persecution now. So, in there had already been waves of persecution before this. We know that James the Apostle, was killed in the book of Acts. So was Stephen, the deacon. But in AD 64, there's a pretty serious persecution that erupts in Rome. And you probably know about this. This is where there's this great fire in Rome, and there was a suspicion that Nero himself had been responsible for setting it. And people were accusing him of doing that, and so he needs a scapegoat. And he chooses the Christians as the scapegoat, and puts many of them to death. And it was really horrible, burning them as torches and stuff like that in his gardens, and riding around in his chariot. Just awful, awful things. And tradition says that Peter and Paul were both martyred in Rome under Nero. And that's probably accurate, but we don't know for sure. So then, from the years 68 to 161, there's kind of isolated and scattered instances of persecution throughout the empire in different places, and just some examples of particular martyrs. One was Ignatius, the apostolic father, the bishop of Antioch. And one of the things that you see in Ignatius, if you read his letters, is he actually wants to be a martyr. He has a death wish. I mean, he really does. He wants to be a martyr, and he got his wish. But he wrote often about this, and here's one quote. He says, this is not what he's saying, you know, on the verge of martyrdom, okay? So it's not like that. It's not like, you know, I'm ready to die, you know. This is actually, you know, he's writing this in a letter to another church and talking about his longing to be a martyr. And he says this, "May the wild beasts be eager to rush upon me. If they be unwilling, I will compel them. Only let me attain unto Christ." So, you know, there's some things you can admire about that, but also it's not really, martyrdom is certainly an honorable thing, but we don't pursue it in the sense that he did. Actually, there's a story told about Origen. Again, we'll talk about Origen next week. His father was martyred. And he was a young man. I think he might have even been a teenager when that happened. And he wanted to be a martyr too. And he was going to go out in public and present himself, you know, so that he could be martyred. But his mother hid his clothes so that he wasn't able to do that. He eventually did die from injuries, though, suffered from torture. So he's technically kind of a martyr. Polycarp, the bishop of Smyrna. Polycarp was probably a disciple of the apostle John. So he probably really was connected to an apostle. But Polycarp, there's this really wonderful passage in the martyrdom of Polycarp when he is being urged by the Romans to deny Christ, to repudiate Christ. And he's an old man. And he says this, 86 years have I served him. So he must have been baptized as an infant, we would assume, 86 years. And he has never done me wrong. Can I, that's a typo there, can I blaspheme him who has, or how can I think that's how, should say how. How can I blaspheme him, my king, who has saved me? I am a Christian. And then he was martyred. And then some other martyrs, Irenaeus of Lyons, we'll talk about him, or Lyons, that's in France, talk about him next week. That's just according to some traditions. We're not sure exactly what happened to Irenaeus. Justin Martyr definitely was martyred. That's how he gets his name. It's not his last name. Justin the Martyr. And Origen, again, probably died, or did die from injuries suffered under torture. So that was the scattered kinds of persecution. And then you had persecution under imperial decree that was much more widespread throughout the empire. And this was in the 2nd and 3rd centuries, especially. So in AD 161 to 180, during the reign of Marcus Aurelius as Caesar, or emperor, he decrees that the property of Christians will be given to their accusers. What kind of effect do you think that had? Yeah. And these are some of the worst persecutions. 249 to 252, so a relatively short period of time, but an emperor named Decius really sought to destroy the church, probably because he believed that the reason why Rome was going downhill is because people weren't worshiping the Roman gods the way they used to. The gods were mad, and the Christians were to blame for that because they had been spreading their gospel. So he attempts to stamp out the church. And then other emperors that did the same thing were Valerian, Diocletian, Galerius. In 303, you have a decree issued by Diocletian that says that which ordered the destruction of church buildings, the burning of the sacred books, the demoting of Christians from places of honor, and the enslavement of other households, or of Christian household servants who would not abjure their faith. Other decrees followed, which ordered the imprisonment of the rulers of churches, offered release to Christians who sacrificed to the old gods, and commanded torture for those who were obdurate. And then there was, the threat of martyrdom as well. But that was kind of a last resort. There were other things that they could do to you before getting to that point. But then in AD 311, the emperor Galerius is dying a horrible death of some kind of a disease. And for some reason, he issues a decree that says the Christians will be tolerated and that the persecutions will come to an end. And they kind of did wind down at that point. And then that's really right on the verge of the conversion of Constantine. So things change quite a bit after that. So next week we'll talk more about some of the heresies that emerged in the first few centuries and how those were responded to. But any comments or questions on anything here? Oh, that he made a profession of faith? I don't think so. No, I don't think that he professed faith. No, I'm not sure about that though. Because Constantine is considered the first to become, to profess faith.